Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yes.
Okay, we resume our meeting.
Because you used it to show slides.
Say hello to the FESB staff, welcome. And we're going to just do an educational session on leases.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you and good afternoon. Hello to Danielle and everyone in Norwalk. We can now see you. We didn't see you for a moment.
You guys have a new camera there. You look, yeah. I mean, sharper than reality almost. Be aware of that.
Anyway, good afternoon. Just a reminder, as we always do at these education sessions, that the objective is that it is educational. Tomorrow's discussion jointly with the FESB is when we deliberate the topics and hopefully make decisions. And today is very much about providing, well, you and us with the opportunity just to, you know, raise any points of clarification and sort of ask any questions of us in preparation for tomorrow's joint discussion with the FESB. This month, we're tackling four papers that sort of discuss measurement. So we've got lease modifications and contract combinations, variable lease payments, in-substance fixed payments, and discount rate. And so our idea today, as we think it's probably good that we try to have the opportunity for you to ask questions on all of the papers. So if it looks like we're dwelling too long on any one paper or getting into more of what is deliberations as opposed to clarifications, then we will potentially move you on in the interest of time. So with that, I think we'll just run through the papers today in order, starting with 3A. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Roberta just to tee up that paper.
Thank you, Katrina. Agenda paper 3A discusses two topics, lease modification and contract combinations. The first section of the paper discusses how to identify a lease modification and how to account for a lease modification, both for LSE and LS. The paper discusses modification affecting a lease or a lease component only, not modifications affecting non-lease components that might be included in the same contract. When a modification grants the lessee an additional right of use that is priced commensurate with its standalone price, both a lessee and a lessor would account for the lease modification as a separate new lease rather than a change to the original lease. When a lease modification does not result in a separate new lease, the paper discusses different approaches for lessee accounting and lessor accounting. For LSE, the paper discusses two approaches. Approach one would distinguish between lease modifications that increase the scope of a lease, that decrease the scope of a lease, or that change only the consideration paid by the LSE. A summary of the accounting proposed under approach one is included in the table under paragraph 23 of the paper. Approach two would distinguish between lease modifications that are either substantial or non-substantial, following an approach similar to that for modification and distinguishment to financial liabilities in the existing financial instrument guidance. The table under paragraph 31 of the paper shows a comparison of the two approaches for lessee accounting. For a lessor, the paper discusses guidance and examples for the accounting for lease modification of type A and type B leases. For IFRS lessors, our understanding is that the paper does not propose any change to the existing practice. Finally, the paper includes a couple of pages that discuss contract combinations. And we are happy now to take your questions on lease modification and contract combination.
Hans, can I ask a question?
Sure.
My question is why we're doing this. And I've had correspondence with Katrina on this, and she nearly convinced me as to why. But on the first topic, we've got a handful of correspondence of respondents that raised it. And it seems like we're going into a lot of detail. This is a 28-page memo. It'll be quite a substantial addition to the standard in the very last instance. And that's on lessees. And then on lessors, I thought we'd agreed at the last meeting, apart from one change that FASB wants to make on lessors, that we wouldn't fiddle with it, that lessor accounting is not broken. So now we're going to go in and change lessor accounting in this regard. And then on the last one, this is a sort of a unit of account question, and we had a few respondents who raised it. And again, I'd go with the people who say you can work it out from the concepts in other places. And I think this is another example of continuing to bring up topics at the end of a project when we're trying to get it finished. But I'm sure there's answers to that, and then I won't have to raise it at the real meeting tomorrow.
So the question is, why?
I can tell you why we decided to write 28 pages, and then you can tell us whether you agree or not. I suppose it's, I think, Ian, look, you're right. If we just took the number of people that commented on these topics, and there were really relatively few, by the way, who made any comments around either lease modifications or contract compensations. And in terms of numbers, I think we could have decided to leave this as a topic that we didn't bring back to you. However, both based on just reading those relatively few comments, the comments and comment letters, and also in some meetings, some outreach meetings that we had, including with a couple of software providers who had, you know, run some calculations and some numbers in these areas, at least we were persuaded that it was a topic that was worth bringing back to you for discussion. And also the other reason was is that in conversations we've had with some of people in practice today who are dealing with questions on leases, actually, given the more recent environment, you know, when there has been some people in economic difficulty, they actually told us that the main question they get today on leases is around contract modifications and how to deal with those. And I suppose, at least to staff, we were convinced then it was worth bringing this topic back to you for discussion, because there was only very few words in the previous ED on the topic, and we thought it was something, at least giving you the opportunity to work out whether we thought just having a few more words of guidance in this area, whether it would be helpful or not.
And what about lessors?
Lessors, sorry, by the way, just because, I mean, for completeness, of course, when we talk about this in the context of lessee, we always like to cover off and consider lessor. And all we're suggesting on lessor is, actually, we don't think it would mean any change, at least our understanding is that what we're proposing for lessor wouldn't mean any change to existing lessor practice. It's simply that there aren't any words at all in I-17 today, which we could decide we want to continue to do, but also just in that respect, we thought it might be worth adding just a paragraph or something that would clarify, you know, given that we'll be addressing it, if we think we should address it for lessee, why not include something brief for lessor?
Because if you do that, isn't there the possibility that you will change practice? Mm-hmm. I mean, once you fiddle with something, you know, we've said lessor accounting's not broken. Once you start delving into the standard and changing things, you can change practice, or at least make it difficult for lessors to understand what they're supposed to be doing as compared to now. Sue?
Okay, I just want to ask a couple of clarifying questions, if I may. In paragraph 12, it says that a lease modification is any change to the contractual terms and conditions that wasn't part of the original terms and conditions. Do you mean that, or do you really mean if there's a change to the right of use or to the payment obligation? So, for example, if I change the governing law, presumably you're not going to treat that as a modification.
Yes, exactly. So the first step is to identify which type of modification are considered contra-modification, and we propose in the paper to include any modification. But the next step is to assess the impact of that modification on the accounting. So if there are no changes to the right and obligation, the contra-modification, the lease modification would not result in any impact on the lease accounting. So but I think just the proposal or the definition, but the fact that there is a lease modification does not mean that there is an impact on the accounting.
I was just going to say that maybe what you might say, Suze, then is that we could change our definition in our standard actually to build that.
I think your words would need to be tighter than
yeah, so we shouldn't have any expecting people to, we could actually define it to say it's any modification that therefore would lead to a change in the
right of use,
in the right of use or the obligation.
And then just a question, if I understand the paper correctly, if you're treating the lease modification as opposed to the sort of a creation of a new lease in addition to the existing lease, in a sense, it's as if you're accounting for the original lease, but accounting for the changes in it. Now, under IFRS, in our financial instruments literature, if I was measuring something at amortized cost and I treated it as the same financial instrument, so I didn't de-recognize it, I treated it as a modification, we would do all of the calculations using the original effective interest rate because it's a cost measurement. But this paper proposes doing the calculations using the incremental borrowing rate at the time of the modification. I just wondered if you could give us a bit of colour for why you chose that. So not where it's booked, not where, you know, whether it goes to P&L versus amounts on the balance sheet, but the discount rate that's used.
I think that the use of an updated discount rate in remeasurement the lease liability reflects the fact that in modifying the lease, the lesser implicit rate changes. And we said that the lesser implicit rate is the discount rate adopted by the lessee. So this reflects the lesser point of view.
But that would also be true if I modify a financial instrument and change the cash flows. It's reflecting the conditions at the time, but because it's a cost-based measurement under IFRS, I think US GAAP might be different, but under IFRS you wouldn't update the discount rate. Is it because you've got an asset and a liability to play with, it gives us a bit more flexibility?
I think that's, well, at least I'll fill in and you tell me, Roberta, if this lines up with your thinking, then I'll ask our FASB colleagues to comment if they've got anything in addition. I think that for us, when we were thinking through it, at least when we started and we thought about anywhere a modification leads to a change in scope, so anywhere you're changing the asset, you're either increasing, adding some, a new right of use, or decreasing the scope. I suppose we were thinking and we saw a link there with that increase or decrease in scope could be done in two ways, but it could certainly affect you know the lease term. In a sense, it could be that you know the modification could increase the lease term or decrease the lease term, and then we were thinking about being consistent with our recommendations that flow through later if you reassess the lease term and whether you change the discount rate. And this was there, we were saying we thought it would be appropriate to update the discount rate at the same time as you update lease term, because we thought the way you calculate the initial discount rate could be affected by what you think the lease term is. So if lease term changes, we thought it makes sense to have a change in discount rate. And so we fed that into thinking about if a modification leads to an increase or decrease in scope. I think that as a starting point, I mean, as staff, we had a discussion, by the way, when we're preparing this paper, whether when there was just, you know, a change to the consideration, you know, and not a change to the scope, whether, you know, we should update the discount rate or not. And there we did recognise that there was a difference in our FI literature, because we were more inclined to think if it's only a change to consideration, it's like a change to the liability, and maybe, you know, we wouldn't update the discount rate. But then obviously US GAAP is different, and I think just in the interest of not creating a lot of different, you know, a lot of differences between the different way you could measure it, we decided to recommend that, you know, you'd update the discount rate as well in that scenario. I don't know. Scott, do you want to add to that?
Scott? I guess just a little bit I would add to that piece is that if you think about you know, a lease modification specific to what the discount rate is intended to represent. I think we've been clear, the boards all along, that what we're trying to approximate is the rate the lessor is charging the lessee. It's just that the lessee doesn't always have the implicit rate available, so they use their incremental borrowing rate. I think from our perspective, if the lessor agrees to change the price or changes the lease in any material way, their implicit rate changes, and therefore revisiting the discount rate that is intended to approximate that by the lessee also makes sense. So I know that's the way we thought about it, less than trying to make a direct analogy to what a paragraph might say differently between IFRS and U.S. GAAP financial instruments guidance. We do have, as Sue said, an asset and a liability here. The right of use is oftentimes what the lessee is viewing as the more important component. What they're trying to obtain is the right to use the underlying asset. And if we try and keep that notion consistent with what the discount rate is intended to approximate, that's how we ended up with this recommendation.
I'm not particularly offended by it, but I think from an IFRS perspective, if we went that route, it would be important we not describe it as an amortized cost-like measurement, because I think it might confuse people.
We go.
Regina, you know, the new proposed standards, there is one important aspect, that is separate the service portion. Because under the current standards, a lot of transactions account for as operating lease. So in reality, quite often the case, people were not separate. And for the new standards, it's quite important. Then my question to you, because at the beginning you defined any changes, then how about if many changes related to the service, which maybe should be carved out? Have you any discussions about this?
Do you want to take this, Roberta?
Okay.
I think that what we would intend to put, if the boards decide to do anything more around lease modifications, is that what we're recommending is that any of these accounting changes and any of the approaches would be linked to a modification or change to any lease component in a contract. So, for example, if there were changes that only affected service components in a contract, that would not be covered via this guidance. This guidance would only cover changes to the, you know, your amount you're paying for your lease. In saying that, I think we have a paragraph early on that would say if you have a lease contract that's embedded within a contract that has other services going on, it might be that if the pricing of that overall contract changes, you might want to look at that initially to say, well, does any of that change relate to my lease component? Then if any of the change does relate to the lease component, I'll follow this lease modifications guidance. If I conclude that any of that change only relates to service components, then you go and deal with it somewhere differently. It wouldn't fall within this guidance.
Yeah, what you just said is what I want to recommend to add.
Okay.
You know, you start with discussions, you know, about whether there is a service which should be separated.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you said, then later on the principle is related to the true lease component.
Mary.
Just Ian, thinking about the challenge that you raised in terms of do we need to do this, and Sue's question about why the change in discount rate, kind of encourages me to say I think it demonstrates to me that I think the value of trying to address modifications in the document, because if I look at approach two, and let me test my understanding of this. Approach two is saying, as opposed to what the staff is recommending, basically let's take an idea that's in the financial instrument standards of both boards and look at how we would define substantial or non-substantial and go that route. And it's specifically reaching the staff and in supporting approach one is in effect rejecting the, just because the liability that's created is a, the lease liability for a lessee is a financial instrument, you don't just look to financial instrument accounting to decide how to treat the modification. And given that we've both been working on our financial instrument standards, we are about to issue a new revenue standard, which you have also pulled in here. I guess it does seem to me that it's worth stopping to think about how all those three things interact. And I think it's helpful to walk through the considerations that the staff has raised in terms of, are we looking at revenue? Are we looking at financial instruments? What are we considering to be ongoing use of the same asset and therefore not a change in how we can compare and contrast that? Now, don't know that we have to capture all of that thinking, you know, in something that we bring into a standard, but I think clarity in terms of how you weave these things together is helpful. Now, if I could just check something that I think is very basic, but when I was looking at paragraph 21B and trying to compare the example example two to example one, is the difference just that example two, it's not the additional piece is not priced at market, while in example one it is, and therefore you conclude that it's a modification of the whole. I think we just have to be really explicit about what, if we go this route, what differences are, because it should be obvious, but because it was silent, it's harder to see. And I guess the last comment in terms of how we approach this and how much we might do to address this concern at this point, while in the staff papers it might be helpful to work through lots of examples, I think we have a tendency to say, oh, we'll solve that by throwing another example at it. And I'm not sure we need to illustrate every possible variation if we go down this route.
Sorry. Just a question on example three and a clarification. So in this case, in this example, there was originally a lease for 10,000 square feet of office space, and it's being reduced to 5,000 square feet, and it's not a proportionate reduction in the rent. So, and the analysis in here goes through a way of doing this calculation and comes up with a derecognition of 41.6% of the asset. Another way of doing it, just on the face of it, assuming that each square foot's, you know, equally valuable, would have been to just say, you know, 50% of the lease isn't there anymore. So is this 41.6% the way that you think it should be done, or is it just an example of maybe how you'd think about it? What was the thinking there in terms of how the pro-ratering should work? Because again, and sorry, just to use the closest analogy that is familiar to me, it's different to how we'd look at a partial derecognition of a financial asset in our literature, where you'd look at the relative fair value of the piece that you've disposed of versus what you've kept. You wouldn't do it this way, so I just wondered why we chose this and if this was meant to be the methodology or just an example of one methodology.
The way that we illustrate in the example three is just an example, so it includes a simplification, because in the staff recommendation that is included under paragraph 23 for change in scope, we recommend to adjust the right of use asset to reflect the partial, in the example three, for example, termination of the lease. So the proper way to reflect this reduction should be to decrease the right of use asset for the amount that is terminated at the modification date. In this example, it could be exactly the 50% of the original right of use asset calculated based on the original amortization plan. In this example, the reduction is 41.6% because it's a combination of two effects. It's a reduction in the scope of about 50%, but it includes also an increase in the lease liability, because there is an increase in the consideration paid for the remaining right of use asset. So the recommendation is to adjust and to decrease the right of use assets for the amount terminated, and then remeasure the liability considering both the reduction in scope and increase in the consideration. So split the two ways. The way that we have illustrated in example three is a simplification that we consider should approximate the result of the adjustments.
Sue, I'm curious, what other way would you do it?
Well, I think, and I'm speaking off the top of my head, but right. I think if you were doing it the way that FI does it, you'd say that you'd look at the fair value of the right of use of 10,000 square feet, and then you'd look at the value of the 5,000 square feet, and you'd de-recognise based on the proportionate value of those two things. So I don't think that the amount of consideration changing to 60,000 instead of 50,000 would come into the calculation. Whereas here, the 41% is a combination, as you say, of the amount that's been decreased in floor area, but also the fact that you've adjusted the per square foot rental charge, and those two things are affecting it. And again, I'm not sure whether I care or not, but I was just interested in why.
And I think what you've identified, so just to clarify, is that in this example, we've taken a simplified way of applying the principle in the context of this example, which is right, and that what we'd propose the principle is, and that what the guidance would say is, you know, you would decrease your asset by a proportionate sort of to reflect that partial termination. And I think what you've indicated it is exactly right in terms of how you should do it. You know, you should be just decreasing the asset by, you know, by a measurement of how much that asset has decreased. And I think that the exactly, you know, correct way of doing that would be potentially to come up with, you know, fair values of the piece that you've, you know, whatever, terminated versus what's continuing. But in this example, we decided to illustrate this in a way that we thought a lot of the time you will be able, you know, to do as a more simplified way of measuring that. But for example, if we used an example where potentially say the liability changes by, you know, I don't know, 100,000, and that was reflective of the fact that there's a tiny decrease, just to be extreme, that the floor space in this example only decreased by 20 square meters or 20 square feet. So it was still the best, then in that case it would really show that the vast majority of the change in the liability would be the result of a change in the consideration, and actually an incredibly small amount would relate to the change in the asset. So you would have a tiny adjustment to the asset, and you know, so very little release to P&L, and the biggest part of the adjustment would flow through, you know, as a consideration change.
Scott, did you want to get in?
Well, I just wanted to point out clearly, because I didn't hear this come up, in paragraph B that comes before example three, we're explicit to say that it illustrates one way in which a lessee might calculate the proportionate amount. So we do not intend, and what I'm telling board members here is that this is not thou shalt do it this way. It's one way that might make sense. We've run a couple more complex examples, for example, that didn't make it here, where let's say you decrease from 10,000 feet to 8,000 feet, but you also extend the term at the same time by an additional 2 years. If you take that example, you really can't do this calculation for that one. You have to look at it more like what I heard Sue say in terms of looking at what's the proportionate decrease in your original right of use. But in this case, we do think this would give you an appropriate answer, but I do want to make clear that similar to, you know, the various ways that you apply these types of changes in RevRec, we didn't, you know, Henry's sitting there, I know, but we didn't necessarily prescribe how you'd have to do that cumulative catch-up or allocation of consideration there. I view it the same way here, that we're not trying to prescribe that there has to be one way to calculate this.
Mary.
Yeah, because I had a note on this one also, and the example had left me with the impression that the change in the ROU asset is determined by the change in the liability, as opposed to you determine the change in the ROU asset separate from the change in the liability. In this case, you might have concluded that the change in the liability is a good approximation of the change in the asset.
Yes.
But, Scott, take your point that you just said this is one way to do it. I'm not so worried about the mechanics, but I think it's the question of whether we believe that one must be the consequence of the other, or if you determine the two separately, you know, and then knock them up and say gain or loss on the consequence.
Yeah, I think that would have been helpful if we clarified that.
But follow what Mary just said, I think if we say that you can use something based on fair value, that big problem, because from beginning, when we determine the initial measurement of the assets, we clearly say it's not fair value based. It's based on the discounted future cash flows of the liability. So,
and I wasn't so worried about specifying it is or it isn't fair value. I think it was just, if we go this route, then would we just say you determine separately the change, you know, the proportion of the right of use asset that has been disposed separate from the calculation of the change in the liability, that would leave open whether it was on the basis of 5,000 out of 10,000 square feet, or, you know, because I read this as implicitly having some cancellation penalty built into the reduction of the liability.
Okay, any more comments, questions? Sorry, Gary.
I think if there's, I mean, I think the subject, the final standard has to address modifications. I think they're so common, pervasive out there, and real estate's a good example of it. But there's usually a lot of moving parts if it's a complicated transaction. So you're not going to lose half the square foot of floor, like you're saying, get proportional reduction in the price. Usually there's, whether there's an extension, whether there's, plus there's oftentimes, you know, effects on non-lease pieces. So if all of a sudden, if this, in this example, is real estate, and you're buying cleaning services from the landlord and helping your employees, funding the common cafeteria of the building, usually there's so many moving parts in here. If these things have any consequence, I think that argues for we need to keep, you know, this really principles-based, and, you know, allow some flexibility in how people go about applying it. So I'm glad to hear that Katrina and Scott said that this illustrates one way, because I don't think we can describe all the ways in here. And my other instinct is, although, you know, approach two sort of put us into the FI standards, I think this board, this organization, same with FASB, might think of these as having lots of elements of FI in it. I think that will generally not be viewed as that way on the street. This will be viewed as a lease, not a financial instrument. I think we've got to write these things perhaps a little bit more in lease speak than FI speak.
I think that's it for that. Okay.
Okay, we'll move on. Thank you. If we move on to agenda paper 3B, variable lease payments, there's two sections to this paper. The first section talks about what variable lease payments to include, you know, in your initial measurement of assets and liabilities. And essentially, the recommendation that's included in the paper under sort of question one or before question one is at least where we as staff are recommending reconfirming what was in the 2013 ED proposals in the context of variable lease payments, you know, meaning that any payments based on future performance or use would be excluded from the measurement of assets and liabilities. And when you measure any payments linked to an index rate, you would use the spot rate at lease commencement, not try to project out those future payments. Then the paper moves on to talk about subsequent measurements and whether you whether we would want to require reassessment of variable lease payments linked to an index or a rate. The 2013 ED proposed that there would be reassessment of those payments at each reporting period, and that is approach one in the paper. We also have two other approaches discussed in the paper that would try to limit that reassessment. approach two in the paper talks about reassessing only when the actual cash payments would change. And so, for example, how that would differ from approach one or the previous ED is it would say, for example, if an entity had to report every quarter, but let's say its lease payments on a particular real estate lease only changed annually, it means that when they would come along and report each quarter, they wouldn't try to reflect changes to the index. If their payments were, say, linked to CPI, they wouldn't adjust the measurement of the liability each time they report. They would only adjust the measurement of the liability when the actual cash payments change on an annual basis. Approach three goes one step further and trying to reduce complexity in that it would say that we wouldn't require any reassessment of variable lease payments other than when the lessee would be reassessing this lease liability for other reasons, for example, because it's changed the lease term or changed an assessment of whether it would exercise a purchase option. So with that, over to you if you have any particular questions or clarifications in the paper.
That is, doesn't seem to be the case.
Good.
The concern I've always had about the variable lease payments based on an index or rate is where the linkage is to inflation. And using the index rate at the date the lease commences, because it seems to me to be inconsistent with what we do in FI. So if we issue an index-linked bond, we don't discount those future cash flows at a nominal rate and get to a measure. It's effectively recognized at a real discount rate, and you accrete at that rate, but also add on the accretion because of the inflation. And it's always troubled me here because it seems to me that for index-linked leases, we understate the asset and the liability. I don't know what the solution is to that, but it strikes me that we're not consistent, well, with IAS 32 in particular.
And is that, are you thinking, I suppose that all stems from the initial measurement then, the fact that we...
It's not even not being consistent with FI literature, it's just not how you'd normally do discounting, because there's a difference between the cash flows that you're discounting and the rate that you're using. They're not consistent.
Yeah.
And my solution would be to specify the use of a real incremental borrowing rate in a situation where the cash flows are index-linked. Now, I know that that's going to be difficult because then there'll be a situation of, well, what if the linkage is not perfectly to inflation and there's something else going on, what do you do under those circumstances? But it seems to me that inflation linking is pretty common mm-hmm. within leases. And I would have liked to see if we could find some way of avoiding that understatement and the mismatch of discounting that Sue points out.
So can I just clarify, Steve, what you're saying, just to understand? So are you saying that whenever initially, so we come along and there's payments linked to inflation, and let's say the starting payment is 100, and it gets linked, that the discount rate that you would apply to that wouldn't just be, let's say it's a 10-year lease, and I start by paying 100, but it gets increased according to inflation annually. That I wouldn't just work out my discount rate assuming I'm only going to pay 100, you know, each year over the 10 years, because that's incredibly unlikely, assuming, you know, there's going to be inflation, I'll pay more. So I'll adjust the discount rate that I use. So I will still, when I initially measure the liability, the cash payments that I'll be discounting will be 100, you know, over the 10 years, but I'll discount those at a discount rate that takes into account the fact that I expect to pay, you know, higher payments as inflation increases.
We have some language in IAS 37, I think, along those lines that talks about making sure that your rate matches how you have determined the future cash flows. So it doesn't say do this or do that. It says if you do this, then use a rate that's consistent in this.
And would that mean having to work out your discount rate by looking at sort of forward curves or things?
No, because in most cases it will be incremental borrowing rate that will be the rate that's used. So instead of that incremental borrowing rate being for just a normal fixed liability, is what would your incremental borrowing rate be for an index-linked liability?
Yep.
Discount at that rate, then unwind the discount at that rate, but also add on the inflation uplift each period as part of the financing cost.
But Pichun, I think maybe my memory is wrong, but we clearly decide in the past to use spot rate. Should we change?
Maybe the spot bill.
Well, I've always questioned this as well, because there's two ways of thinking of inflation. There is the price index, and then there is the rate of inflation. Mm-hmm. So implicit in a real rate is current expectations of inflation. But if we specify the price or index as being the price index, then of course you get to the answer that we had in the ED.
And under your suggestion, would you require reassessment of the payments then, or because you've taken into account the real incremental borrowing rate at the start, you wouldn't need any?
Yeah, there's no need to reassess. You don't reassess an index link bond.
Mary?
I want to ask a question about paragraph 18, which is one of the places where the arguments are laid out about not including variable payments that do not depend on an index or rate. And it's just that when I was reading this, it brought to my mind many of the discussions we're having in the conceptual framework discussion right now about liabilities and, you know, contingent liabilities. I recognize that that's at a discussion paper starting to work towards exposure draft stage, but I think it might be worth, if we are commenting, for example, in a basis for conclusion about this analysis, to flag up that the strict "you have no obligation until the obligating event has occurred" is inconsistent from my perspective with, you know, much of the discussion we've been having.
Would you agree with 18B in that regard? Because that's where I come from. I agree with the conclusion in question one, but I'd say I'd go with 18B, and it's on cost benefit grounds, not on asset liability grounds.
I was much more focused on the cost benefit analysis, especially because as I thought about this, well, 18A characterizes in the sense of right obligation to make and right to receive, you've already got the item, and what you get doesn't change. So it's really about how much you're paying for what you're getting. It isn't whether or not you will be forced to acquire something additional.
And if it's helpful, I'll just tell you that when the boards discussed this last time before the previous ED.
Sadly, I missed that.
Well, no, you won't miss anything, because I'm sure you'll get to discuss it again.
Sorry.
But no, I just wanted to clarify and let you know that some board members, I think, you know, even for the, you know, majority of both boards who agreed to kind of what we're suggesting, you know, here in the paper and there were board members in both camps, by the way, in both 18A and 18B. So for some board members, it was very much cost-benefit decision. You know, these are absolutely assets liabilities and this cost-benefit. For others, it wasn't. And we in the previous basis made sure that we explained it in that way, not to say that based on leases, we are concluding on whether these are absolutely assets and liabilities or not. So if it ends up, you know, being the same way, then we can ensure the basis is reflective of the board's discussion in that respect.
I think I'd rather sit by Ian in 18B.
On the issue of cost benefit, that's essentially where the staff has come down in terms of making their recommendation. Thinking about the evolution here of the process of implementing the standard and the expectation, at least, that you'll have a
a significant amount of software vendors trying to design solutions for those who have to implement this. Over time, the cost of implementing a standard that would involve assessing how variable lease payments would factor into your asset and your liability, in my opinion, probably should go down. And the reason is because all this stuff will be in a system, it'll be systematized, and in fact, you'd be prompted almost every quarter to review certain leases, perhaps based on information that's available. So if the board actually believes that, in fact, you have a liability, but isn't going to recommend that you have to account for them in the liability for cost-benefit reasons, that's one path. But let's say you have a company that actually believes they are a liability, has the ability, in their view, to make reliable estimates, and wants to account for them accordingly. Essentially, all we're doing is we're deferring the timing of when one company might recognize this expense versus when another one. But if ultimately, they'll always recognize it to the extent it exists. So I guess what I am wondering here is whether or not we're going to actually opine on whether or not this is a liability or not, or remain silent on that. Because as Mary says, if the evolution of our thinking here is such that, in fact, if you can make reliable estimates and they're practically unavoidable, certain obligations should be recognized. This might, in fact, be the poster child for that kind of scenario. And so if cost, essentially, the costs come down over time, then why wouldn't you want someone to recognize it? So I guess my question is where are we going with the principle first? I have no objection to not requiring it today, but just as we've seen an evolution, for example, in option pricing models over time, we'll see, and estimates of fair value, we'll see an evolution here. So why prevent an improvement in financial reporting when we don't have to?
Well, I think the only, and sorry, correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, with what you're maybe thinking about is obviously that let's assume that the boards are along the lines of at least some of the recommendations that they say, okay, you know, for now, given that this is a new standard, et cetera, that we think the costs would outweigh the potential benefits of requiring, you know, all of these things to be included. So we're not going to require it now, but are you potentially saying, but we would draft it or write it in such a way that we would allow people to the extent that they feel they can measure these amounts with reliability, that, and at whatever point they can, they would then...
That seems to be consistent with our thinking in revenue recognition, and I think that, you know, that's could be where we get to. It seems like that there was more leaning in that direction in the discussion paper on the conceptual framework than there wasn't.
Or is there just a simpler point underlying your comment that if we decide now for cost-benefit reasons, let's describe it as for cost-benefit reasons rather than throwing up a conceptual hurdle by labeling it as...
Right.
Or raising some question about whether it's not really a liability yet, or whether looking at paragraph 21, it's a form of risk sharing that means you don't. And it would be better to say it's cost benefit, even if we didn't say or imply, if you can do it, you're open to it, because that might create a degree of diversity that is less helpful than, you know, the incremental accuracy on one entity. But we don't create a conceptual barrier that we then have to deal with when we want to revisit it either later or elsewhere, a similar issue.
Yeah. I'm not worried about the diversity, because today you have diversity in estimates of loss contingencies across the board, and that doesn't create non-comparable information. But I'm more concerned about the point you made, which is creating a conceptual barrier to the recognition of a liability.
But as Pat, if follow what you said, it seems quite, you know, a good idea. But whether it should be a general principle for everywhere.
Yes,
we should not discuss
anything,
any leave because of cost. And what we only need is something innate. You know, if it will create with the term we use, you know, impractical or undue cost or effort. Then you can use simplified way only for yourself, But as a principle, we never discuss. What do you say?
Well, I'm just saying right now, in the context of this standard, if in fact you believe, as the preparer of the financial statements, the cost of making these estimates exceeds the benefits, okay, that you're going to get, the precision in the estimate of liability, then go ahead and make that judgment call and book it based on the minimum contractual. But if, as I said, time goes by and the systems supporting this area of accounting improve and you can actually make more reliable estimates within a certain, you know, bandwidth, then I would say go ahead and let them do that.
That gives an option. That's effectively an option.
Yeah. That would be an
accounting option.
Yeah. Accounting option. That's effectively an accounting option based on management's judgment about whether
but that's
the benefits
essentially what,
of doing the calculation that way it's
what,
cost.
That's what IAS 37 is today.
Like.
That's what IAS 37 is today, Pat.
No, it's
yes, it is. Yes, it is. If I can't make an estimate, if I believe it can't make a reliable estimate, I don't make it, and I don't book it.
That's the extreme.
No, it's not the extreme.
Liability.
No, it's not.
Pat, I think here's a case
this
where
a contingent liability.
You probably can make a reliable estimate as the estimates, you know, as your like indexes go up and stuff. It really
people
is
are saying they can't. People are saying they can't.
Well, the information exists. Your lease reprices, you know, month 13 for the next 12 months based on the inflation or whatever.
Right.
So the information exists in your organization because you've got to write, cut the check for month 13.
Right.
I would, you know, I always find it very difficult to say you don't have to do it if its cost is impractical. Because that's almost, if the information is in your building,
yeah,
it's very hard to argue it's not.
That's why I wouldn't write it down.
I would be very worried. Yeah. Yeah. About having to do that.
You see, Ian, that this paper was not at all superfluous. It leads to all sorts of very interesting accounting in general.
There's a bit of ones we had mixed up with already.
I think we just need to be. I mean, just to clarify clearly, I think that the way that you know, you guys, the way the basis was drafted last time around, Mary, to your point, was very deliberate. First of all, it was absolutely a reflection of the board's discussion, but obviously there also was very clear intention that we wouldn't be, you know, jumping over kind of, say, the conceptual framework project and what are the definitions of assets and liabilities, you know, within leases. So we were very cognizant of that, and I think that, you know, again, depending on the board's discussion tomorrow, we can ensure we do that. I do think that what Patrick's suggestion is, I agree with Patricia, that would absolutely, in my view, be adding an accounting option in this respect, and therefore that's something to think about if we really want to do that. But maybe in the interest of time, then we'll move on to the next paper. Next paper is in substance fixed payments. And here, essentially, this is where, by the way, we did include the notion of in-substance fixed payments in the 2013 ED, to say, of course, just because a payment is potentially labelled or written to appear to be variable, but if it's really in-substance fixed, then clearly you should account for it and treat it as fixed. We're recommending continuing to do that, but based on feedback, we would potentially suggest just adding a bit more flavour to what we mean by that by adding some examples. And there are some potential examples in the paper. So again, just open if there are any clarifying questions on the paper.
So someone already asked whether, you know, we try to solve problem by providing examples. I can see the benefits, but the problem is, you know, if you want to add any examples, you must describe the scenario and then create a problem. And someone come in and say, oh, I understand the principles, but my scenario is slightly different from this, whether I should apply or not. So I think we should be very careful. Unless it is necessary, I don't think we should provide example. You know, particularly if we expect we create some kind of, you know, unintended consequence. As I said, you know, you will describe the scenario, and people say, oh, the principle is okay, but my scenario is different from these examples, and then create a problem.
Aaron?
I was concerned also about the number of examples without feeling that they added more than an example that addressed the specific fact pattern covered, kind of what Wigwell was just saying, because when I look at, for example, paragraph 19 in the discussion, I'm not sure that we need to give lots of illustrations of terms that are non-substantive, because, you know, that seems to be something we should be able to say, ignore non-substantive. And then when I got to example two, which is labeled disguised in substance fixed lease payment, I wasn't sure why it was disguised. I mean, I know it says you tried to make it extreme, I assume, by saying CU1 per year unless sales are more than 10,000. But given that I don't know what the exchange rate on CUs is, I'm not sure what the company's track record is of sales, how that relates to, you know, whether 10,000 is you open the door and the first customer spends that, mm-hmm. or, you know, whether it's a real stretch. So actually, I think it comes back to saying, is it some, one of the phrases that's used in the paper is, I think it's remote that you won't have to pay it. Is it, you know, is it an extreme probability? Is it when it's variable so that it's tied to future actions? I don't see what the clear line is here, and that's what I was struggling with. But I want to echo Weiguo's point about adding in lots of examples, unless it's a very clear this is what's different here.
Do any of the words in 19A or B, just in the words before the examples, help at all or hinder?
Let me come back to you.
Yeah, fine.
Gary? Yeah, I'm sure where Wago is to, I think less examples is probably less is more, perhaps might be, but what are we trying to accomplish? The examples, most of them are fine. You got, you know, some anomalous terms, but we're after anti-abuse is what we're after, I think, in this particular, you know, agenda paper. And when we say when you have payments of terms that don't create genuine or true variability or whatever, I think two parties still have to agree to these terms. This is not a unilateral thing. I mean, the person who's going to be receiving the cash, the lessor, you know, has got to agree to it. And I think there'll be some sort of a limiting on there that you, if there, no one's going to agree to something that's so disadvantageous. So I think there'll be a somewhat of a normaling of results, but as opposed to examples, that must be inclined to have a list of indicators what are potentially abusive terms, you know, sufficiently different from industry practices, sufficiently significantly different from your prior practices, you know, terms that might not be viewed as commercially reasonable or whatever, as opposed to examples. So, I mean, we'll keep working it. I think we're all in the right place on this thing, but I think the examples, I don't think quite do it.
Sue?
I had similar issues in terms of trying to understand exactly what we're trying to scope here. So I couldn't work out why some examples were okay and some weren't. And when I got to paragraph 20, and it said that an entity would not include lease payments that vary solely on the basis of future performance, blah, 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 regardless of the probability of occurrence, I then didn't know how I reconciled that to example two. Because it's so certain, we've said that's okay to include it, but paragraph 20 says if it's based on performance, no matter how probable it is, it's not in. So I couldn't reconcile some of the different paragraphs in the document in this paper.
I mean, sorry, I'll try, and then Scott or Jafar, please come in if I don't respond to this correctly. I think that maybe, by the way, I accept maybe with example two, we should have explained it slightly better, because I hear, you know, Mary's comments and your questions on it. But I suppose we were, the presumption behind example two, which again, we should have said is that somehow, you know, the sales of 10,000 is a very, very, you know, small number in the context of this lessee. So the way this has been structured is to kind of ensure that you'll always have to pay a million, but just try to make it appear like the million is, you know, on paper variable when
it's just such a hard line to draw, though, because paragraph 20 is all about the fact that, and let's not forget that we've decided that if it's based on performance, no matter what the probability is, it's out. But then we're saying, oh, but not always, really.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you need so many examples, because it's not a clear-cut line. And if we try and use examples to draw the line, I think it's never going to work.
I'm not sure what you can do there here. So I felt that what we were trying to do with the last ED was just to put something in there so that the auditor or regulator confronted with an abusive situation could say, just call foul, and would use their judgment to sort of police it. So it's, to me, it's 19A is the key thing, I think. It's about the notion of saying what you've got in there is not true variability.
And somehow the contrast, which clearly we haven't done in the best way, you know, with example three, is to try and say, well, somehow in example three, it seems like it really is true variability in there for genuine commercial reasons that say the amount I'm going to pay is kind of directly linked to the amount of my sales, as opposed to having, you know, as opposed to the kind of looks like, you know, it's not in any way kind of, the variability isn't directly linked to the variability in future performance. But maybe
it's better just using words like 19A than all of these examples, because I think maybe they make it harder.
Jafar, Scott, do you want to add something here?
Well, I would just add that I think I wasn't here when this was re-deliberated the first time, but I understand from all the people that were, Petrina, Danielle, etc., that this was something where it just became very difficult to come up with a way to explain this in words. I think what, at least from our perspective on this side, what we thought we were doing with these examples is providing examples that were a little bit different from the ones that were in the 2013 ED. I don't think we would envision including these plus the ones that were in the ED, because the comments we got from a number of constituents were that the examples in the ED were really just showing fixed payments, not in substance fixed payments. So they weren't really giving any flavor for the type of scenario we were trying to capture with the definition. So I think it's important to understand that these examples, at least on the U.S. GAAP side, exist in the firm's interpretive books. They actually exist in at least one of the big four firm books on the IFRS side as well. So these are things that we're more or less trying to illustrate to some extent with these examples, that this concept exists today, and we would not envision that the boards would want things that are considered minimum lease payments today to not be lease payments tomorrow. So using examples like these that most big preparers are probably familiar with their firm's accounting guidance seemed to be a logical way to somewhat explain what we were shooting at here.
Can I test whether I understand what the genuine variability means?
Yeah.
What if we have a ceiling on the example three, so it's about 5%, but if you have a, if you set the ceiling of 8% or something, and you know quite well that this company may have, ceiling of sales may exceed 100,000, but you know, it could exceed 15,000. So then you put the ceiling on the sales of 15,000. So in that case, is it the true variability?
Sorry, let me just see if I understand your question. Are you saying that if we had example three, but there was a, so it was 5% of sales, but maybe it was only 5% of sales, say up to 5 million of sales, and then
there is
that was a cap. There was no more variable payments. I think we potentially still think that that would be, there would be true variability.
But up until 1500. 150,000. So the sales volume start with something zero, then it's quite sure that it would exceed 100,000. So then it starts, you know,
start paying percentage rent.
And then, but there is a ceiling. you know.
So there is a cap that says the there's a maximum amount of variable lease payment you would pay because so there is what we have termed genuine variability up until a point, but then at that point, you know, the maximum amount of, say, so it would be example three, except you might say there's a maximum annual lease payment that you will make.
Right, but...
Is that right?
No, but if you know quite well, it stays on maximum every time.
So it's going to be at cap level, which...
Which is kind of
getting close to example two.
Which is getting close to example.
Yeah, but in the case of example two, it's related to the index. But in the case of example three, it relates to the variable payment other than index. So therefore, people may misunderstand that in the case of index-related variable payment, then it could be disguised one. But in the case of performance related, then everything could be possible. So therefore, example three could be dangerous.
Yeah, I mean example three is trying to illustrate, well, if the boards agree that they think that any payments that are directly linked to future performance or use are not part of, you know, of your lease assets and liabilities. They're simply not, even if the payments are like, say, it is in example three. So you don't, even if we assume an extreme case where all of your payments are variable based on future sales, so you pay nothing if you make no sales, but every time you make one sale or two sales, you know, you pay something. Even in that scenario, we'd assume that if that was the case and these are 100% variable based on future sales, then you would have no asset and liability at the start, because that would be true genuine variability linked to future performance. But I think what your question raises is maybe like Sue's question is, how do we maybe very clearly distinguish between that example three scenario and what we're maybe trying to do with example two?
Shall we go to the last paper?
The last paper's on discount rates. A couple of sections here as well. So first of all, I'd say there are a couple of recommendations or analysis around the lessor's discount rate and how we define the rate the lessor charges the lessee. And in essence, we've got two recommendations there that really kind of essentially say that we would retain IAS 17 with respect to the rates the lessor charges the lessee. So the first is that we'd define that in a way or describe it as simply the rates implicit in the lease, and the second is that we potentially propose to that you would include initial direct costs in that definition, just as a, not as a change to the previous ED in a sense, but just as a simpler way to do lessor accounting in that context. And the next part of the paper then goes on to talk about the lessee's discount rate. And if we think there's any changes needed around thinking about, you know, the definition of a lessee's incremental borrowing rate. And I think here we're recommending that we retain essentially the definition of incremental borrowing rate that's consistent with the previous ED and also pretty consistent with existing guidance. But potentially here as well that we could add some clarity by adding some examples, and we could also consider clarifying when it might be appropriate that you could use the parent or the group incremental borrowing rates, you know, when working out your lessee incremental borrowing rate. And I suppose the paper in an appendix to the paper, there are some of those illustrative examples just included there. So again, any clarifications?
I had one. When I read the principles in paragraph 29 and 31, with respect to essentially substituting the parent's credit rating for the subsidiary, that made absolute sense to me, particularly when there's formal documentation to that effect, when a parent provides a guarantee or there's a support agreement in place. But then when I got to the example in the back, and I think it is example four, here I didn't really see the application of that principle. This was written rather loosey-goosey. It basically was essentially giving one complete carte blanche, and there was no assertion that, in fact, the parent was providing a guarantee or there was a support agreement in place. So here, my observation was, it is not fair to make this assumption without adequate support, and there should be some clear recognition through a support agreement in order to make that assertion. Otherwise, I think you have to look at the subsidiary on a standalone basis.
I think that, and I'll start, and Steve or Scott add to this. I mean, I think personally, I think you're right, Patrick, that in examples we need to be clear to have all of the appropriate assumptions we'd need to, because in the paper we do try to make clear that if you know, you think it is appropriate to add any clarifications here, it's very important that it's done in the context of making clear what our objective is, and the objective with the discount rate is always to try and use the best measure of the rate in the contract, which is, I think, what you're saying is, and even the way even the requirements work at the moment is that a lessee sort of first and foremost would use the rate the lessor charges the lessee, the rate in the contract, and you're almost just using your incremental borrowing rate as a proxy or a practical way of getting at that. So I think that maybe what you're saying is this example four doesn't adequately link to that overall objective of kind of making it clearer that in this case, you know, what the lessor would have considered in pricing the contract is pretty much the, you know, the parent's sort of credit rating, etc.
Because the parent has either given a guarantee of this lease or has a general support agreement in place for the sub, which they don't always have.
Yeah.
Or do.
Patricia?
It's basically the same point. And it goes to paragraph 27, where the conclusion that they should use the parent's rate is based on the fact that the subsidiary doesn't have a treasury function. And in my view, whether or not the subsidiary's got a treasury function is irrelevant if we're trying to approximate the rate that the lessor is charging the lessee. It's going to have more to do with whether or not the parent is guaranteeing it, what currency is it in, is the lease in the parent's currency or is it in the subsidiary's currency, what's the inflation rate in the jurisdiction in which the asset is and the payments are being made, all of those things. So I think if we're going to give any guidance, and I'm not sure we should, going back to Ian's point previously, because it sort of implies that no one really, not many constituents raise this issue. But if we're going to give guidance, it's more about what you would look at to determine whether or not the parent or the lessee's incremental borrowing rate best approximates the rate implicit in the lease, because that's what we're trying to accomplish, is a rate implicit in the lease.
Steve or Scott, do you want to add anything?
No, I think we'll just take that in and we'll... Let's go with that, because I understand the point being made, and it's similar to what we said on modifications. I don't disagree that the objective is that. That's part of why we thought we would update the discount rate in the modifications paper, is for that same reason of what it is that we're trying to approximate. So I don't disagree with that. I think that defining the exact circumstances in here for this paper or even in a final standard, when that would be appropriate and when it wouldn't, is merely just a difficult task. I think the way you should look at this a little more broadly is that I think what we're aiming for is a decision that would say you agree that there are, in fact, circumstances where that should be the case. And in our minds, some of those circumstances that we were thinking about were, yes, there's going to be some very clear circumstances where a written guarantee has been in place, but it's not always going to be quite that clear. But yes, it shouldn't be a free choice for every entity where it clearly doesn't reflect what it's intended to reflect. But I think you're recognizing that some of the wording is, it's hard to define on a dime, so to speak. It's a concept that we think is reasonable, but not, you know, overly narrowly tailored.
Do we really need to say anything about this? Doesn't the principle of the discount rate do everything that it should do? And we don't we risk just confusing everybody?
We could do. And maybe there's just a question of whether the objective, the simple objective, is just clear enough. And
so support the point of view.
Yeah, permeates all these papers really. And I'd also be interested to have a list of what changes are going to be made to lessor accounting if these were adopted. Because I thought we'd agreed that we don't want any changes to this or again.
And only to clarify that point, in the context of this discount rate paper, what we're suggesting here is exactly to meet your objective there, because what we're suggesting for lessor discount rate in this paper is to bring us back to existing lessor accounting.
But there's some modifications out there. I mean, there's some details in there that bother me a bit. I know the overall, but in this paper, with other papers, there's more extensive modifications, but even in this one there's some minor. Why are we doing it?
Okay. On that, there's a question. We finish our deliberations for today and we'll continue tomorrow.
Before we go, Hans, can I just flag up a point that I've raised privately with Petrina and wanted to put out about the small ticket, which is not coming back at this meeting, and I know that, but you just had something in here about plan for further deliberation. I've been thinking more about our discussions in March and the very challenging assignment that we gave the staff in terms of doing more research to try and at least qualitatively assess the significance of the small ticket exemption. And I wondered if it would be at all productive for the staff to look when they're doing that, especially if you find it's difficult to answer that question satisfactorily, whether we could address the same objective still having some kind of small ticket exemption along the lines we decided, that instead of saying it takes you out of the scope of the standard, says you would be, I guess, permitted to use undiscounted liability and either straight line or cash recognition. So you still have small ticket exemption practical relief. It is what people have to do today for lease liability disclosure, so it's not at all incremental to current burden. And it would avoid the complexity that people complained about with, you know, discounting for things that are small ticket and large volume. And I just wanted to raise it now because the staff has laid out in some of their papers what they're planning to bring back. And I just have, as I've been thinking about small ticket and some of the concerns that were expressed about potential loss of information versus disclosure of those amounts today, and can we get a handle on the magnitude, I didn't want to wait another meeting until we have that paper back to ask about considering that alternative. I'm sorry it's late, but it's just following up on those things. And I wanted to raise it today during our ed session in case there was some reason that came to you right away that you would say off the table for, you know, when we discussed it tomorrow.
Noted.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much.